Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now reconvened.
Please call the case.
Case number SDAP-14-843, McDermott v. Ige. Arguing for the appellants, Sean A. Luis. Also appearing for the appellants, Robert K. Matsumoto. Arguing for the appellees, Deirdre Marie Iha. Also appearing for the appellants, Donna H. Kalama. Argument on the merits.
Well, good morning, counsel. Are you both ready to proceed, Mr. Luis? Oh, Ms. Marie Iha, good. I just want to note for the record, we've received several letters submitting additional authorities for consideration of the court under our Rule 28J. Got a letter from the appellants November 24th and from the appellees October 6th and December 8th, the most recent of which indicates that Governor Ige has been automatically substituted for Governor Abercrombie under our appellate Rule 43C. So thank you very much for your submissions, and we're ready to hear argument. Mr. Luis.
If it may please the court, in this case, the legislature shall have the power to reserve marriage to opposite sex couples. Those 12 words are found in the Bill of Rights of the State of Hawaii Constitution. It became Article 1, Section 23, that has remained unamended since 1998 when it became a constitutional amendment. As part of that process, under the legislative process, it first was House Bill 117, and it was voted upon, including my client, Representative Bob McDermott. He voted in favor of House Bill 117, along with the majority of the senators and representatives at that time. It then went on the ballot as a ballot measure in 1998, and on November 3rd, 1998, 69.2% of the citizens of Hawaii voted an overwhelming majority in favor of House Bill 117, which is now the current Article 1, Section 23. In the words, the legislature shall have the authority to reserve marriage to opposite sex couples. That is the only 12 words that appears in Article 1, Section 23. It doesn't say anything about same-sex marriage. It doesn't say anything about redefining marriage. The plain, unambiguous language present in Article 1, Section 23, 12 words, simply says the legislature shall have the authority to reserve marriage to opposite sex couples. In addition to that, attached to the motions for preliminary injunction was the official state ballot question sheet from the Office of Elections. And it stated there that the meaning of a yes vote would add a new provision to the Constitution that would give the legislature the power to reserve marriage to opposite sex couples only. The legislature could then pass a law that would limit marriage to a man and a woman, overturning the recent Supreme Court decision regarding same-sex couples. At that time, the state and its official information to the voters in the state at that time in 1998 told them that if the meaning of a yes vote would add the new provision that the legislature has the power to reserve marriage to opposite sex couples only, not that the legislature has the power to redefine marriage or to change the definition of marriage in this state. And the meaning of a no vote importantly states that a no vote will make no change in the Constitution of the State of Hawaii.
You're reading have the power right out of that provision, aren't you?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm reading right out of the voter general election guide.
No, but I mean you're reading have the power right out of that provision. You're interpreting it that the legislature is required to do it.
No, Your Honor, that's respectfully what it says. It says that the legislature shall have the power to reserve marriage to opposite sex couples, and that's the only power that is authorized there.
To reserve it, in other words, the part of the language I think that Justice Pollack is asking about is the power to reserve. Does that in any way modify or purport to limit the legislature's power under other provisions of the Constitution to define marriage?
Yes, it would limit the custom and ordinary powers of the legislature under Article 3, Section 1, because when a constitutional amendment occupies a space in the state constitution, any contrary intent to the statute, the meaning of the statute, would be unconstitutional.
Why wouldn't the amendment have simply said the legislature shall reserve marriage to opposite-sex couples, or marriage shall be reserved to opposite-sex couples? What is the import of the language being included, have the power? Doesn't that imply some discretion on the part of the legislature?
It does not, Your Honor, because when you look at the 12 words in their total context, it's a state constitutional amendment that is limiting marriage to opposite sex couples. That's the intent.
If the legislature exercised its power, couldn't the legislature have not exercised its power, and they would not be in contravention of the Constitution, would they?
Well,
if they elected not to?
The legislature did exercise its power. There was actually no implementing legislation that ever took place either. The 572-1 Hawaii by statute, the marriage law under Hawaii by statutes, it was never amended from 1997, 1998, and including up until the special session in 2013 when new language was granted. So there's never any implementing legislation that was required.
Isn't the placement of the word only significant in that in the actual ballot question, it doesn't state that the legislature has the power to reserve marriage only to opposite sex couples? It doesn't say that in the ballot question, does it?
It says in the ballot question, and I think it's important, the Kalbaum case says that you need to look at not only the intent of the framers and the drafters, but you need to look at the intent of the voters as well. And what the voters were told is that a meaning of a yes vote would add a new provision that would give the legislature the power to reserve marriage to opposite sex couples only in Article 1, Section 1, the Bill of Rights that belongs to the people. In Article 1, Section 1, it says that all power belongs to the people of the state.
So your argument is that we're supposed to reinterpret the plain language of what this provision says to mean something that you say it means?
Not what I say it means. That the
12th, or what you say other people thought.
Well, if you look at the ballot question, that was the official state ballot guide for the voters at that time. It was telling them that it would reserve marriage to opposite sex couples only. And that's why we cited in our briefs that there's case law, canons of construction going back, that whenever a constitutional amendment says one thing, anything to the contrary is unconstitutional.
So assuming that you're correct that it's unconstitutional, then this provision is unconstitutional. It doesn't reflect what was adopted. So is it rescinded or nullified? Is that your argument?
No, Your Honor, because whenever the Constitution is presumed to be constitutional, whatever was enacted, and no one has ever challenged Article 1, Section 23, it still remains the law that was passed. So it's still intact, and the court presumes the constitutionality and interpretation of a constitutional amendment that it will stand and not fall in. The meaning, when looking at the Kalbaum case, we need to look at the intent of the voters. And the intent of the voters was to make a ban on same-sex marriage.
But we would only get to the intent of the voters if there's ambiguity in the plain language of the provision. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes.
How is there ambiguity in the language as it's drafted, where it says they shall have the power to reserve? It's a grant of power, but not a mandate to exercise that power. That would appear to be the most natural reading of it.
Well, the two sides that have come forth show that both sides strongly believe that there's ambiguity as to what it says and the interpretation. And then because of that, we need to look at the Kalbaum case and look at the intent of the voters. And
who did you say? I missed the statement you said. Who has said it's ambiguous?
Both sides have submitted in a brief that it is plain language, or any alternative that it's if it's not interpreted as plain language, and there can be two interpretations, that it's subject to analysis under ambiguity.
What about the intent of the legislature when they proposed the amendment? That would be relevant, correct, in the analysis? Because oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. I'm going to cut you off.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. The Kalbaum case says that it's necessary that both the intent of the drafters and the voters has to be considered.
Well, let's start with the drafters. There's actually a section to HB 117 where it states the purpose of this act is to propose an amendment to Article 1 of the Constitution of the State of Hawaii to clarify that the legislature has the power to reserve marriage to opposite-sex couples. And then it goes on later to state that this constitutional measure is thus designed to confirm that the legislature has the power to reserve marriage to opposite-sex couples and to ensure that the legislature will remain open to the petitions of those who seek a change in the marriage laws, and that such petitioners can be considered on an equal basis with those who oppose a change in our current marriage statutes. Does that not imply that, again, there's a grant of power to the legislature, but the expectation that the legislature has the discretion to change but is not required to change?
But in Article 1, Section 1, it says that the power belongs to the people. So the powers of the legislature in Article 3, Section 1 have to be looked at in the context of the Bill of Rights, and the customary and ordinary powers of Article 3, Section 1 are modified by the Bill of Rights. It would be just as if the state tried to ban guns under Article 1, Section 17, or tried to forego the requirement of a warrant under Article 1, Section 7. There's already a constitutional amendment that occupies that space, and whatever the purpose of the statute is, anything contrary to that would be null and void, and it would be outside the customary and ordinary powers of the legislature.
Mr. Luiz, could I ask you a question about your view of the power of the legislature at this point? Because it's my understanding that your position is that it would be unconstitutional for the legislature to act as it did in 572-1 and allow same-sex marriage, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And if that is the case, are your clients concerned about how that may conflict with federal constitutional law that says that that is a basic right? Right to be able to engage in marriage to the opposite sex or the same sex?
Yes, Your Honor. My clients are sympathetic to that. In fact, if we were asked questions about what would happen if the law is struck down, Senate Bill 1 that became law as unconstitutional, the court has equitable powers to fashion some sort of remedy or be remanded back to the trial court. And the same is with the federal proceedings.
I think Justice.
What remedy would you contemplate that might cause it to survive a constitutional challenge that was a federal constitutional challenge?
Because we have the split in the circuits right now, including the 9th, the 10th, and the 6th, it could be that one potential remedy is that whatever the court's order is, it could be held in abeyance until the outcome. If the United States Supreme Court grants cert on the split of authority right now under the federal constitution and issues any subsequent ruling, because that would have an impact on this case.
And the Ninth Circuit has recently invalidated. And in fact, if our law would probably be invalidated at this point in time if the Marriage Equality Act hadn't been enacted. Is that correct?
It is possible that if someone brought a challenge now, it could be invalidated. However, because Senate Bill 1 is in law right now, the court already in the Ninth Circuit in the Jackson versus Abercrombie case dismissed that lawsuit as moot because whatever relief was asking for was mooted out. So right now,
it was mooted out, but the court said, because of the marriage equality law and that the plaintiffs had gotten married. So my question is, if the marriage equality law was invalidated, then the Ninth Circuit would have invalidated this constitutional provision. It seems very clear.
Well, if the if the Ninth Circuit had looked, well, we don't know that, Your Honor, because actually the case was dismissed on mootness and justiciability.
What did it do with all the other cases that were from the other states?
Well, the Sixth Circuit has said that.
I'm saying the Ninth Circuit. What did they do?
They dismissed the Jackson versus Abercrombie as moot, that any relief that the plaintiffs had requested in that lawsuit was mooted out by the passage of the marriage equality.
Yeah, I'm talking about Idaho and Nevada.
It's only the Sixth Circuit and also the district court in Louisiana and Puerto Rico that said that under Baker versus Nelson, 1972, the case that is still in effect that came out of Minnesota that's never been overruled, that there is no federal constitutional right to same-sex marriage.
In essence, you're asking us to call a law unconstitutional. That's the Marriage Equality Act. That's what you're asking us, right?
Yes,
under an unconstitutional provision. So do we look at whether a law is unconstitutional or constitutional when the constitutional provision itself is unconstitutional?
Well, the only question before the court right now is whether the marriage equality law was properly set forth in law and whether or not the legislature could still exercise its customary powers under Article 3, Section 1.
But you're asking us to do that by applying it against the constitutional provision that itself is unconstitutional, at least by the vast majority of the courts and the Ninth Circuit.
But Article 1, Section 23 has never been challenged, and it is still a valid constitutional amendment. So it would be speculation, with all due respect, Your Honor, to say that it would be struck down as unconstitutional when no one's ever challenged it from 1998.
Mr. Louise, I think Justice Pollack is following the analysis of what potentially could happen if we do feel that federal case law is sufficiently clear. I mean, is your client concerned that this court may decide on federal grounds that Article 1, Section 23 is unconstitutional?
Well, we don't know that, Your Honor, because Baker versus Nelson has never been overruled, the 1972 Minnesota case. It's still the law. It says there's no federal constitutional right to same-sex marriage, and that case has never been overruled. So
can't we interpret a federal constitutional provision? And, in fact, our Hawaii state constitution is part of the very, right after the preamble of the Hawaii state constitution, it adopts the federal constitution. So the federal constitution is integrated into the Hawaii constitution. And since it's integrated, so is the equal protection clause and so is the due process clause part of our constitution. So in essence, Act 1, Section 23 may already be unconstitutional or of no effect.
However, under Baker versus Nelson, 1972, this court would be overruling that rather than allowing that case to stand. That's the precedent that is still good law. It's never been overruled. So
let me ask you this, Mr. Louise. Is the constitutionality under the federal constitution of Article 1, Section 23, has it been challenged or raised in this case?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. And I just want to take before we go much farther on the merits, I would like you to address the threshold question of standing, if we could. And that's, of course, our cases have required a injury in fact under a three-part test, that the plaintiff suffered an actual or threatened injury as a result of the allegedly wrongful conduct of the defendants is the first prong. I'd just like you to address how you believe that injury in fact test has been met in this case by the various plaintiffs, and in particular, if you would start by addressing Mr. Kumia and his claims. And his declaration of what the impacts were on him.
Yes, Your Honor. First, this is a matter of great public importance. It changes the very definition of marriage in the state for the first time in decades. So the Supreme Court precedent that we cited in our briefs says that in great matters of public importance, standing is relaxed. So looking at it in that context, Mr. Kumia is a citizen who voted in 1998 for House Bill 117, and when the legislature enacted the marriage equality law, Senate Bill 1, it nullified his vote. So that's where his standing comes from in a matter of great public importance. And I think that's the most important evidence set forth in his declaration that gives him standing, is that he voted for House Bill 117 in 1998, and it was overturned.
Can any member of the legislature who votes for a statute that's later overturned then have standing to challenge the statute that overturned what he or she voted for?
Yes, Your Honor, because we cited cases in our brief as well on that point, and that's why Representative Bob McDermott has standing, because he voted for House Bill 117 in 1997 that became law.
And his vote hasn't been nullified.
His vote for House Bill 117 that became Article 1, Section 23 was nullified when Senate Bill 1 passed the third reading and was eventually signed into law. The legislature, when it voted in October of 2013, it nullified his 1997 vote for House Bill 117 that became Article 1, Section 23.
I just wanted to return to Mr. Kumia and his supplemental declaration, in which he said that he's a community liaison pastor, and I'm also a men's youth family and marriage coach, as well as a men's youth family and marriage conference and motivational speaker. And he stated that he would refuse to coach a same-sex couple, and that he fears that he would be the target of a hate crime, and also fears that he would be subject to a lawsuit based on his refusal to be a coach because of his religious beliefs. Is that does that constitute actual injury in your view, or is that not a position that you're relying on to establish standing in this case?
No, Your Honor, we're relying on the votes that were taken in 1998 by the private plaintiffs in this case. That is the most important ground for standing in a matter of great public importance that changes the definition of marriage in this state for the first time.
When you say the votes that were taken, what do you mean that what the private citizens actually voted for? Is that what you're saying? I don't know what you mean by the phrase votes that were taken.
Representative Bob McDermott voted with the majority of...
Oh, I thought you were talking about private citizens. Didn't you say something about private citizens?
Yes, they voted. They're part of the 69.2% who voted overwhelmingly on the ballot question on November 3rd, 1998, that House Bill 117 became Article 1, Section 23. They're part of the 69.2%.
Let me just be clear then. There were supplemental declarations from Mr. Hashimoto, Mr. Kumia, and I believe Mr. Langdon as well, in which they talked about various things that they did or activities they engaged in, and concerns that they had about, or that in Mr. Langdon's case is concerned about impacts on his granddaughter. Did I understand you? Are you saying you're not relying on those declarations to establish standing?
Yes, Your Honor. That was before I was part of the case, and we're relying on the vote itself that was nullified.
Okay, thank you.
And I reserve some time.
You can reserve time to come back after we've heard from the counsel for the appellees. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Deputy Attorneys General Deirdre Marie Iha and Donna Kalama, appearing on behalf of the Governor and the Director of the Department of Health, appellees. We thank you for the opportunity for oral argument. Your Honor, since most of your questions just now were talking about standing, I'll start with that. Your Honor, this Court's decision in Model versus Miyahira indicates that the plaintiffs do not have standing. In Model, the Court found that two legislators did not have standing to challenge the Payroll Lag Act because they lacked a, quote, distinct and palpable injury. This is completely consistent with the United States Supreme Court decision in Raines versus Byrd that found that an individual legislator could not challenge the constitutionality of the Line Item Veto Act. Just as importantly, the Court also concluded in Model that value preferences do not suffice to establish standing. There are four plaintiffs, as counsel has mentioned, Representative McDermott, and three individuals. To the extent that any of them relies on value preferences, Model is controlling, and their value preferences are insufficient to establish standing.
What about the fear of being sued? Is that the kind of injury that can constitute injury in fact?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Injury in fact cannot be based on speculation or conjecture. So to the extent they're afraid of things that might happen in the future, that would be insufficient to establish injury in fact.
What if there's a First Amendment interest at stake? Are there lower or lessened requirements for actual injury when there are associational or First Amendment interests being asserted under the federal, certainly under the federal case law that we can address first?
That's interesting, Your Honor. Typically, under First Amendment federal case law, you don't actually have to show that you're going to be prosecuted under a First Amendment violation. You can anticipate that it's going to apply in the future as it does now. For Mr. Cumia, who's the man who is the pastor, he's talking about he's working as a marriage counselor and his views about how he doesn't want to counsel same-sex couples. To the extent that he's involved with the solemnization of a marriage, then he should be under the solemnization provision that's in the Marriage Equality Act itself. There are two provisions in the Marriage Equality Act that explicitly protect those who may disagree. There's a solemnization provision which prevents any clergy from being made to solemnize a marriage if it is against their religious beliefs, and there's the facilities provision.
But so your argument is that he would not be subject to a lawsuit because he may have defenses, correct?
Well, correct. I mean, and the both of the religious provisions in the Act are very strong. They actually say that the people are immune from any legal consequences.
Do we know, does the record show what a community liaison pastor means? Is that an ordained clergy person, or could it be more of a lay pastor? And does that come in under this, within the protections of the statute, since you're relying on those defenses?
Oh, okay. Honestly, the extent of his role was explained only as said in his declaration. So since I'm not prepared to speculate about how he actually works. So I don't know. But the rest of Chapter 572 that governs who may perform a marriage, which includes judges, retired judges, and clergy, allows the religious organizations themselves to define who is clergy. So I'm not going to tell them who their clergy is.
Well, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Ms. Marie Iha, explain to us why we shouldn't relax standing in this case to encompass a matter of great public that Mr. Luis says is great public.
Certainly, Your Honor. The plaintiffs claim is standing for the individuals, or even to the extent that they're basing it on a voter nullification theory. The difference, in my view, between the cases where the court has relaxed standing and this one is that the plaintiffs are not injured by the Marriage Equality Act. On its face and as a matter of law, the Marriage Equality Act didn't take anything away from these plaintiffs. In fact, the Act doesn't take anything away from anyone. Everyone who was eligible to marry before the Act became law is still eligible to marry today. Every right, every responsibility, every protection of marriage is exactly the same as it was before. So in my view, plaintiffs have not been injured by a law that does nothing more than grant rights to other people. And in the recent federal marriage cases, and there are a very lot of them, several of the courts have actually commented in analyzing requests for injunctive relief that objectors to marriage equality are not injured by allowing same-sex couples to marry. So for example, the Campaign for Southern Equality versus Bryant from the Southern District of Mississippi, quote, allowing same-sex couples to marry, however, presents no harm to anyone, unquote. Brenner versus Scott from the Northern District of Florida, quote, those who enter opposite-sex marriages are harmed not at all when others are given the liberty to choose their own life partners and are shown the respect that comes with formal marriage, unquote.
Well, let's talk about Mr. Cumia. If he doesn't fall within the exception for pastors and he engages in speech or counseling in a public facility, would he potentially be subject to liability if he could not rely on the protections in the statute, and if he were to explicitly say that he would only coach opposite-sex couples?
If I just want to make sure I understand your question correctly, you said that, let's say, he's outside of the scope of the statute. So if he's outside the solemnization exception, in order for the Constitution, of course, only governs the conduct of the government. So in order for individuals to have any law that requires them to not discriminate, it has to come under one of the other provisions.
In a public facility? Right, so people can use a public facility and discriminate in ways that are prohibited under our Constitution?
There would be probably the application of the Public Accommodations Code would decide that question, which is if the place is open to the public. So the classic example is a restaurant. But it doesn't matter who owns the facility. It doesn't matter if it's for profit. And it doesn't matter whether it's free or not. What matters is whether it's open to the public. So if an individual is, the example that came up over and over during session was the individuals who actually serve in the wedding industry, right? But if an individual is running a business, then our law prohibits them from discriminating on the basis of either sexual orientation or a gender identity and expression or marital status.
But that's not his allegation. And in fact, he's never even alleged that he's been asked or ever refused to coach a same-sex couple.
That's correct. It's
his declaration says nothing like that.
That's correct, Your Honor. He basically is, at the point in time in which he said it, the Marriage Equality Act was not yet even law. The declarations that appear in the record are, in fact, the same declarations that were attached to their preliminary injunction motion, which was initially filed while the bill was still in the legislature. And it's the same declarations that appear later. So he has not added to any facts to say that someone actually came to him and he had to turn them away.
What about Mr. Hashimoto, who does talk about using public facilities for various types of advocacy purposes? Part of my duties as chairman of the Hawaii Christian Coalition is also to utilize public facilities from the county and state for purposes such as parades, conferences, and prayers. If same-sex legislation is passed, I will be irreparably harmed and no longer able to conduct and oversee such activities in those public areas because I do not accept same-sex couple relationships as substantially equal to man-woman relationships. Is that sufficient to raise a suggestion that his activities are of an actual injury?
I still think it's speculation, Your Honor, but putting that aside, the scenario that Mr. Hashimoto explained is talking about his using a facility that belongs to someone else, not him running the facility. So the Public Accommodations Code governs the person who's running the facility. So, for example, when the schools allow community groups to use their cafeteria, they are obliged to open their doors evenly. And they can't actually tell a church no. So they are using that way. So it would govern the school can't discriminate, right? It wouldn't necessarily mean that they have to say that no one who enters these doors can ever have their own personal views. So I don't think the Public Accommodations Code would go that far. But none of the record in the case gets to that, Your Honor. It's only stated in these declarations about the things that they're afraid of. So,
Mitzi, if I could ask you a bit about the idea of relaxing standing where there's a matter of great public importance.
Mm-hmm.
This concept, I mean, we can agree is based in part on whether there's a matter of great public importance, but would it also depend on whether there's really indecision or a question about that matter of great public importance? In other words, what I'm alluding to is if the analysis in this case is that there's no lack of clarity about public policy. I mean, we have a constitutional provision that's been passed that allows for same-sex marriage and allows for opposite-sex marriage. And in addition to that, there's been a clear statement of public policy through the Marriage Equality Act, 572.1. All right, it's a matter of great public importance, but the policy you may, under that analysis, say is clear. So if that's the case, if there isn't a real question about a matter of public importance, is there the same need to relax the standing requirement?
Well, that's very interesting, Your Honor. I can see where you're going with that, and I think it kind of dovetails into the idea that the court would only want to decide a live controversy, right? So if there's no disagreement, the public policy that is greatly important, but it's coming through loud and clear from the legislature in their most recent action. And so it would, I think, the situation you've outlined would actually cut against the necessity for standing, because there is no dispute about what public policy the state of Hawaii has adopted here. If I could, Your Honors, I'd like to turn to the nullification theory that Mr. Ruiz was emphasizing. This argument was brought up in the reply. They argue that their votes for the constitutional amendment were nullified by the Marriage Equality Act. And we see this as partially based on Coleman, which is that federal legislative standing case. Your Honors, it is wrong as a matter of law to characterize Article 1, Section 23 as being nullified in any way. It accomplished its stated objective. It allowed the legislature to limit marriage to opposite-sex couples for 15 years, from 1998 to 2013. So it did work, so to speak. Without it, it is very likely that Hawaii would have had marriage equality many years ago, perhaps as early as 1997 or 1998. So it is inaccurate to describe this provision as nullified. Second, plaintiffs offer no authority to support their implicit assumption that Coleman, which by its terms is limited to legislative standing, should also be applied to individual voters. And third, Coleman does not support Representative McDermott standing as a legislator because Coleman concerned the legislator's vote for the law in question being nullified. To fall under Coleman, Representative McDermott would have to argue that his vote for the Marriage Equality Act was nullified. He does not make that allegation, and it does not appear anywhere in the operative complaint. This argument also puts the cart before the horse. Representative McDermott's assertion of standing is based on his argument on the merits. That is his interpretation of Article 1, Section 23. He says, the Marriage Equality Act nullified my vote for Article 1, Section 23 because that's what this means, but that's the merits. That's not how standing works. As this court put it in Citizens for the Protection of North Kohala Coastline, quote, standing is the aspect of justiciability focusing on the party seeking a forum rather than on the issue he wants adjudicated, unquote. Even if all these other concerns were put aside, Representative McDermott still cannot establish standing under Coleman. As explained later by the U.S. Supreme Court in Raines, Coleman only establishes standing when a block of legislators shows that they had the votes to enact or defeat a bill, but that their votes were nullified. Representative McDermott cannot make that showing. I also think it's important to talk about this court's ruling in Hanabusa versus Lingle. Hanabusa shows that legislators have standing only when some aspect of their legislative authority has been taken away from them. In Hanabusa, this court found that the deprivation of the opportunity to advise and consent on executive appointments was sufficient to establish standing. Representative McDermott, in contrast, has not been deprived of any opportunity to exercise his authority as legislator. The legislative record from the special session cited in our brief shows that he did exercise that authority. I'd like to turn to the merits, if I could. Your Honor, our position is that even if the plaintiffs had standing, they still cannot prevail. The Hawaii State Legislature has the general power to regulate marriage, including regulating who may enter a marriage.
Do they have the power to adopt a discriminatory law in the way they did? In other words, the only purpose of this amendment was to give the legislature the authority to discriminate.
You're asking about the constitutionality as the law before the Marriage Equality Act was passed, I assume, if I'm understanding your question correctly. So I would divide that into sort of two levels of analysis. The first is whether the state possesses the authority as granted by the state constitution to regulate marriage. Whether the exercise of that authority violates the federal constitution is a separate question. So I would say that the constitution was amended, as far as we know, entirely properly to put Article 1, Section 23 into the constitution. And at the time, the federal case law had not come anywhere near where it is now.
I understand, but we have a situation now where there's no valid application of that provision. At least that's when...
As to Article 1, Section 23, plaintiffs are incorrect that it was never challenged. The plaintiffs in the Jackson's case actually did challenge Article 1, Section 23. And because the Ninth Circuit dismissed that case as moot, that question was never addressed. But in my view, Article 1, Section 23 is not unconstitutional, and the reason why, and in fact wasn't, never was, because it by itself did not limit marriage to opposite sex couples.
But the only purpose of it was to discriminate because the legislature already had the ability to not discriminate. So the only purpose
of... Oh, I see. Right. Well, the question has not been raised in the case, so I don't think it's necessary for the court to go there. But as I see it, if there was any discrimination in Hawaii statutes before the Marriage Equality Act was passed, it was statutory, right?
But yeah. You're correct, it hasn't been specifically raised, but if we find standing in this case, we're going to have to interpret whether the marriage equality law is constitutional under an unconstitutional provision.
Well, I don't think
an unconstitutional provision provide any legitimacy to a law?
Well, the Marriage Equality Act does not depend on Article 1, Section 23. The Marriage Equality Act was enacted under Article 3, Section 1. That's the legislature's general authority.
Well, that's a different argument.
Right. So there was a little bit of confusion about this in the record below, but it has always been our position, and our Attorney General who argued the summary judgment actually said this to clarify during the circuit court proceeding, is that it has always been our position that the authority to do the Marriage Equality Act came from the legislature's general authority to regulate marriage, which is the police power. And we have never thought that Article 1, Section 23 was the source of that power. So it comes from the larger authority. And the one way to think of it is, if Bear had never happened, if Article 1, Section 23 had never happened, the Hawaii State Legislature still could have passed the Marriage Equality Act because they're acting under their general authority. So in my view, the state of Hawaii has always had the power to say yes to this question. After Bear, the Article 1, Section 23 gave them the option to say no. And that's how it's structured in terms of the power in the Constitution.
So if there was standing, you believe we could decide this case without ever referring to that provision, in a sense, at least to authorize those?
That's correct, Your Honor. It is not our position, not at all, has never been, that Article 1, Section 23 is the source of the legislature's authority. The police power, as reflected in Article 3, Section 1, is the general legislative power, which covers pretty much everything. And that the fact that marriage falls within the police power is essentially beyond dispute. You have a statement in Loving versus Virginia, marriage is a social relation subject to the police power. You have a statement in Windsor acknowledging that the New York's decision to recognize marriage for same-sex couples was, without a doubt, a proper exercise of its sovereign authority within our federal. Yes.
Ms. Ehoff, I could interrupt you, and you could help me with this. Don't all provisions of the Constitution apply to statutes?
They do.
Mm-hmm. So an argument is being made in this case that Article 1, Section 23 applies to the Marriage Equality Act. And I appreciate your I think, suggesting a point of view that would say that we don't need to address that issue because we can find that the Marriage Equality Act was passed under a provision of the statute, I mean a provision of the Constitution separate from Article 1, Section 23. But nonetheless, it would seem that as a basic proposition of constitutional law, Constitution does apply to all the statutes, and in that case, I'm a little unclear, and I don't expect you to take a position necessarily, but I'm a little unclear. Are you taking a position at this point with respect to Article 1, Section 23, that says that it is valid, even in the context in which it's, I think, can be clearly seen, that context in which it essentially allows the discrimination on the basis of sex?
Well, I think it's a very interesting question, Your Honor. I think it would leave us in a rather interesting scenario, because if Article 1, Section 23 was struck down, then we go back to Bayer, which would presumably result in marriage equality, which we already have. So it would go a little bit in a circle. But
okay, you've talked a lot about the circle that could be created, and I'm not expecting it to I just want to be clear. You're not taking a position at this point on the Constitution.
No, I don't think that we have to.
In fact, we can resolve this case without taking a position, and as I understand your argument, without taking a position one way or the other on whether Article 1, Section 23 survives review under the federal Constitution.
I think you're correct, Your Honor, that question has just not been raised. Whether the Marriage Equality Act is consistent with Article 1, Section 23, that is the contention that has been raised by the plaintiffs. So in terms of, yes.
But even to make a determination of consistency, I guess the question I'm bringing up, when you evaluate something to see if it's consistent against a constitutional provision, there would seem to be some supposition that what you're evaluating it against is constitutional.
Correct, Your Honor. And our position, of course, is that when you're looking at the current state of Hawaii law, which must by necessity include the Marriage Equality Act, that Hawaii law is constitutional because it doesn't discriminate against anyone. So I essentially would return to what the court said in the Bayer 1999 dismissal and say, regardless of whether it was unconstitutional before, it's constitutional now. So it's essentially the same thing. Only now, the question's been answered. We are opening the doors to marriage for everyone. In our view, Article 1, Section 23, to address the question the plaintiffs have brought before this court, this provision is absolutely clear. We believe it means what it says, and the court doesn't have to go any further. Your Honor, when you asked about whether plaintiffs were reading the phrase, have the power out, I think you're correct. They want this to be a ban on the recognition of marriage for same-sex couples, but it just doesn't say that. What it says is shall have the power, meaning they have the authority, the discretion, to decide whether to limit marriage to opposite-sex couples. Even if Article 1, Section 23 was ambiguous, the legislative history unmistakably supports the same conclusion. We have House Bill 117, which Justice Rechtenwald read earlier. We have statements from numerous legislators quoted in our brief, all say the same thing. The legislature retains power over this decision.
What about the argument that we should go to extrinsic sources like the accounts of what was being said in the news at that time?
Your Honor, I think extrinsic sources would first only be relevant if you found the provision to be ambiguous, right? So if it's unambiguous, then you don't even have to go there. You look only to the intent of the provision. If the court does find that it is ambiguous and you look to extrinsic sources, I think you would want to weigh those extrinsic sources by how far they are away from the provision itself. So the closer they are to the bill that became law, the more weight that they should carry. So the heaviest extrinsic source is the prefatory language in House Bill 117. A little bit further back, the statements from the legislators. A little bit further back, the ballot provisions. The statements that are made in the media or the opinions of individual voters would be entitled to less weight as an extrinsic source, in my view, because they have that much more distance between them and the law that actually became part of the Constitution. Calbon does envision that if the provision is ambiguous, you can look to various sources of extrinsic intent. It does not mandate that the court look to any one in particular, so you would pick them based on the appropriateness of the circumstances. And I think we've outlined fully how the surrounding circumstances all fully demonstrate that the legislature knew exactly what it was doing when it picked House Bill 117 to become the constitutional amendment. There were other bills in 1997, even before and after, that would have made Article 1, Section 23 read like the plaintiffs wish it read. Those bills never passed the legislature, were never placed on the ballot. So all we have is what was part of the ballot in 1998.
And do you think your analysis of Calvin is that we could look at extrinsic sources, but we should prioritize what sources we look at?
Yeah, I think you would have to, Your Honor, just because there's something that was controversial could have a very lot that was said about it, right? So I don't think that you would want to be getting into that. I mean, if you check the records, there were more than 400,000 people who either voted yes or no on this provision. So if the court is looking to determine intent, when you have legislative intent for a statute, you don't go to the legislators and ask them to fill out a declaration about what they meant, right? Legislative intent is something that's read, a question of law read from the text. So in our view, the intent of this provision, including the intent of the voters, starts with the text itself, rather than what individual people will say 15 years later about what they meant when they cast a vote in 1998. If I could turn for a minute to the doctrine of constitutional doubt. Your honors have raised the question of the great weight of the authority in the federal courts. It has been a very exciting year on this issue for the federal courts. When Hawaii passed the Marriage Equality Act, we were the 15th state to have marriage equality, and there were 35 states without it. Today, as I stand here, those numbers have been flipped. There are now 35 states where same-sex couples may marry and only 15 states where they cannot. The difference between that one year and change is what's happened on this issue in the federal courts. There have been dozens and dozens of decisions. The only three that have upheld the bans is Puerto Rico, Louisiana, the two district courts, and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. There are petitions for cert pending from the Sixth Circuit decision. Louisiana's plaintiffs have actually tried to skip over the Fifth Circuit and go straight to the Supreme Court. Their case has been set for the January 9th conference before the Supreme Court. So it's a very hot and interesting issue right now in the federal courts. Taking all of that and knowing what's going on in the federal courts surrounding us today, the doctrine of constitutional doubt supports the circuit court's decision. In our view, Article 1 in Section 23 is unambiguous, and even if it was susceptible to plaintiff's reading, the doctrine of constitutional doubt tells this court to reject that reading. Our answering brief and the two 28J letters offer a very long list of citations about why plaintiff's interpretation of Article 1, Section 23 would place the provision into serious doubt as to its...
You're arguing the constitutionality of that provision.
No, Your Honor. I'm arguing the doctrine of constitutional doubt, which does not depend on the answer to the provision, the answer to the constitutional question. It depends on the existence of the constitutional question. And I'm not saying that Article 1... I'm saying that if plaintiffs were correct about what Article 1, Section 23 says, then it would be unconstitutional. I'm not saying that what the text actually reads is unconstitutional. I don't believe it is. I believe that if anything was unconstitutional prior to the passage of the Marriage Equality Act, it was Hawaii's statutes.
Oh. But do you see the problem of trying to measure a statute against an unconstitutional? Assuming it's unconstitutional, we're evaluating it for its consistency, its plain language, its legislative history. We're making all these evaluations, kind of giving it the stamp of approval by applying those particular legislative interpretation or statutory interpretation tools in order to find that the statute's constitutional against a provision that itself is unconstitutional, at least by the huge majority of federal courts that have looked at it.
Right, Your Honor, but I would say that if Article 1, Section 23 ever, as it is written, not as plaintiffs interpreted, if Article 1, Section 23 was ever in the past unconstitutional, the only way it was is because in concert with the statutes as they existed at the time. So, like I said, it's almost like the mirror image of the 99 Bear dismissal. Even if it was unconstitutional before, it's not unconstitutional now, because the Marriage Equality Act has any discrimination that used to exist is gone.
But wait, you think that even in light of the Marriage Equality Act having been passed, you would argue that provision, Act 1, Section 23, is constitutional now?
I don't think that question is not before the court today, but I think that if it was unconstitutional at some point in the past, it wasn't unconstitutional by itself. So if we're correct about Article 3, Section 1, and Article 1, Section 23, then the Marriage Equality Act could have been passed 5 years ago. It didn't have to be passed just last year. So what you're looking at it is the only way that discrimination actually entered into Hawaii's law was when you put them together, the statutes and Article 1, Section 23.
You know, the federal constitution continues to have a provision, I think it's in Article 1, maybe Section 3, where it says when they're counting for representation, free men shall be counted and other people get 3/5, and
correct.
Indians not. And that provision is still in our federal constitution.
It is.
And that's very similar to the existence of Article 1, Section 23 in our Hawaii constitution, that even though it exists, it's not constitutional. And in fact, what happened there is the 14th Amendment was passed, so it superseded it. And my question to you, I think that that's what's happened to Article 1, Section 23. It's been superseded by the due process and equal protection clauses in the federal constitution.
I see your question, Your Honor, but like I said, I don't think that the law that prevented a same-sex couple from marrying was not Article 1, Section 23 by itself. It was that and the statutes which were passed in 1994 in response to this court's Bear decision. So Article 1, Section 23 couldn't implement it by itself. It required the legislature to act. So the constitutional question that was raised in the now moot Jackson case was whether those two things together were unconstitutional.
Do you need an implementing statute for a constitutional provision to be unconstitutional under the federal constitution? I don't think so.
I agree. I think I got a little lost with the constitution, but yeah, I agree. You do not. If one of our state laws is unconstitutional under federal law, then it's unconstitutional. Right? I see my time is nearly finished. Any further questions?
If you have any final thoughts, please go ahead and wrap up.
Thank you, Your Honors. Your Honors, Hawaii's journey toward marriage equality has been a long one. It began with Bear, and it ended 1 year and 16 days ago when the Hawaii Marriage Equality Act went into effect. Even if plaintiffs have standing, they have failed to demonstrate that the Marriage Equality Act is unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt. We respectfully request that this court affirm the constitutionality of this important law and that it do so without delay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Luiz, your rebuttal. If you would, why not? If you would start with standing, that would be helpful since that's a threshold question. If you have any response to the arguments that were made on that point.
Yes, Your Honor. The state misconstrues the Coleman case. It stands for if a legislator's vote is nullified. And Representative Bob McDermott, his vote was nullified. And that's the other cases that we cited as well. We cited the Silver case. We cited the Kennedy case. We cited these other cases as to why when a legislator's vote is nullified, that gives the standing that's required to challenge the law. And
as for an ordinance that says driving on King Street is 30 miles an hour, and then they changed it to 35 miles an hour, does a council member have standing because the next body of law council people change their minds?
But in this case, the state changed it under a Hawaii by statute, and they didn't amend the Constitution. They were free to put it back on the ballot, and they could have put it on the ballot for this election that just passed, and they could have taken the vote and seen if the majority of citizens would have amended Article 1, Section 23 to include same-sex marriage. But they chose not to do that. They used their custom and ordinary powers instead of making it a ballot question or a constitutional convention. And that's why Representative Bob McDermott's vote is nullified, because he voted into existence House Bill 117 that became Article 1, Section 23. And when Senate Bill 1 passed in a subsequent legislation, it nullified that vote that became a constitutional amendment. It's just like any of the other there's 25 articles within the Bill of Rights and Article 1. The legislature doesn't have custom and ordinary powers to alter whatever the purpose of those constitutional amendments are. The state can't ban guns, Article 1. Section 17. It can't use its custom and ordinary powers to make, for example, Senate Bill 2 that would make a ban on guns in the state because there's already a constitutional amendment that occupies that.
And so in order for Mr. McDermott to have standing, we'd have to agree with your interpretation that the Senate Bill 1, that the Marriage Equality Act violated Senate Bill 1. I mean, doesn't he have to establish standing independent of a legal conclusion?
Representative Bob McDermott just has to establish that he voted for House Bill 117 that became Article 1, Section 23 in 1997, and that his vote was later nullified during a 2013 special session by the state legislature.
But essentially that would provide a cause of action for all legislators when there is a statute passed after a constitutional amendment that they think doesn't comport with the Constitution.
Well, in this case, we're specifically looking at the Article 1, Section 23 that was put in place by whoever voted with that majority, not only Representative Bob McDermott, but other individuals who voted for House Bill 117 would have standing as well.
Well, that may be, but I'm just trying to be clear about the standing that's going to be granted to legislators in the future. All legislators who find that a statute that's passed after a constitutional amendment doesn't comport with, in their view, the vote they made for the constitutional amendment.
Well, there would be several requirements. They'd have to still be in office. They would have had to have taken the prior vote that became the constitutional amendment.
Yeah, an ordinary citizen, vote on the constitutional amendment, and in addition to that, be a legislator, and then watch and see what happens with the legislation after the constitutional amendment, and if they don't agree with it, they file a lawsuit.
But we don't have to worry about that, Your Honor, because if we just look at the cases that are brought forth, there's not many that actually come forward challenging under, you know, a separate lawsuit for injunctive relief. There's a very small number of injunctive relief lawsuits to bring a sort of challenge like this that was brought forth. So I don't think that we have to worry about that. It will open the floodgates to more intensive litigation.
What about standing with regard to the other plaintiffs? Any further argument there? And if not, then move on to the merits, if you'd like.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. The individual plaintiffs, they voted in 1998. They're part of the 69.2%. The state should be a stop. This law was put forth in Article 1, Section 23 as a ban. And when you look at the Bear versus Meiki case in 1999, this very honorable court, vacated the 1996 trial court ruling that Hawaii Revised Statutes 572-1 violated discrimination on the basis of sex, or Article 1, Section 5. And it vacated that trial court finding. So in 1999, in Bear versus Meiki, this very honorable court found that Article 1, Section 23 was constitutional because it didn't say that it was unconstitutional law, and it didn't strike it down. It actually used Article 1, Section 23 to grant a disposition order and take judicial notice of the statute under the rules of evidence, Rules 201 and 202. And it said that it elevated, at that point, it said that that law was constitutional, and it vacated the trial court's 1996 opinion that the marriage law at that time discriminated against. So this very court, honorable court, recognized that Article 1, Section 23 was constitutional at that time, and constitutions are presumed valid. And in this case, it's like the state keeps forcing the courts to look at the trees rather than the forest. That there's already a constitutional amendment in place, and for all 25 of those amendments, the legislature loses its custom and ordinary powers to act. It can't make, it can't allow the police, for instance, to go into houses without warrants, without probable cause. It can't pass any law under the custom and ordinary powers of Article 1, Section 7.
Sorry to interrupt you, but your time's almost finished, and I did want to see what your response was to the argument, if I understand it correctly, by Ms. Iha, that it's not necessary for us to address Article 1, Section 23, because this statute was actually passed pursuant to other provisions of the Constitution.
It is necessary because Article 1, Section 23 occupies that space, and when the legislature passed Senate Bill 1, it was under its custom and ordinary powers that are already occupied by a constitutional amendment. And all 25 amendments are the same. They usurp the legislature's custom and ordinary powers to act. And the only way that the legislature can act under Article 3, Section 1 is consistent with the state and federal constitution. And Senate Bill 1 was inconsistent with Article 1, Section 23 at that time.
Did you have any further, would you like to address the merits anymore at this point, Mr. Luiz, or any other subjects?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, briefly, I know your time is expired, but if you'd like to touch upon those subjects and wrap up for us, that would be fine.
Yes, thank you very much. When we look at Article 1, Section 23, it plainly states that the legislature shall have the power to reserve marriage to opposite sex couples, and all three branches of government are equal. And the legislature, the judiciary, the executive, they're all equal and must follow the state constitution. And the plaintiffs brought this lawsuit because Senate Bill 1 usurped what was already a valid constitutional amendment that was recognized by this honorable court in 1999 in Bayer versus Maiki. And we ask that because of that, our clients have standing, their votes were nullified under the cases that we cited in our brief, that under the plain language that the legislature shall have the power to reserve marriage to opposite sex couples, that language is plain, that that's the only authority. It doesn't give authority to redefine marriage or do anything contrary to the intent of Article 1, Section 23. But in the alternative, if the court finds that that is ambiguous, we need to revisit the Kalbaum case and look at not only the intent of the drafters and the framers, but the intent of the voters as well, in the official state ballot questionnaire explanation that is attached as Exhibit B to our motion, as well as the state's motion for summary judgment in Exhibit E of that document. It shows that the voters were told that if they voted for this, it would make sure that marriage was between opposite sex couples only, and that's what they relied on when 69.2% overwhelmingly voted for Article 1, Section 23 to become law.
And your argument continues to focus on the constitutionality of Article 1, Section 23.
Yes, Your Honor, that in all constitutional amendments are presumed valid, and this honorable court recognized in Bayer versus Maiki in 1999 that it was constitutional, because otherwise it wouldn't have overruled the trial court's 1996 judgment and vacated it and dismissed the named plaintiff's lawsuit at that time.
Very well. Anything further at this point, Mr. Luiz?
Just to conclude, we ask that the court find that the passage of the marriage equality law is in violation of Article 1, Section 23. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you to both of our counsel, all of our counsel here, for your arguments today. The court will take this matter under advisement.